With Inspire Podcast, we're dedicated to bringing you the latest research in medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, and everything in between, from both students and academics in a language everyone can understand.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com. You can find our website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk, where you can access original research and articles from students, or find out about how you can get involved. Today we're doing another research roulette episode. So the last one we did was on software a few weeks ago, and this time we have had quite a fun suggestion from someone on Facebook to do one on the word medieval. So in case you didn't listen to our first episode, research roulette is basically a game where we all have to go away and basically find a scientific paper relating to this random word, and then we come back and discuss it and see how weird and far-fetched we went in relation to medieval. So how have you guys found it? How have you been this week?
Not too bad. It seemed fine. It's actually quite a struggle to find like a good quality paper, I believe, because you want to find a paper that actually has like some sort of robust kind of reasoning behind the information. So it was a bit of a challenge, but I think I have a paper to discuss today, so we'll see how that goes.
Also, medieval is just, that was a very long time ago, so there's not much medieval data out there. So it's all quite literature review-y, I found.
Yeah.
There's like some, one of the things that I found is some archaeological stuff, but you're always stuck making inferences. But one of the things that I find interesting is when sometimes medieval information is kind of either like analogous to stuff that we have today, or it's kind of carried forward, and that's something that I will talk about briefly when we get on to my not quite one article but just my topic that I think will spark some interesting discussion.
I'm excited. I think as I've mine is a very, very rogue article. Like, I really don't think it's loosely related to medicine, it is, but I read it and I thought, I bet no one else is going to have found this, and I think it's a pretty, it's just pretty fun, I think. Might have a nice time talking about it. I don't think it's something we've talked about before on the Inspire podcast, so the first time for everything.
For today, I haven't so much got a single article to talk about as more just a general topic. I think one of the things that's really interesting about the medieval era is the way that it's not just, I guess, a medieval thing, but it's also kind of a cross-cultural thing, and we can kind of discuss this in more detail, but the way that sort of disease is defined based on what we understand about it. So as like a just to frame what I'm talking about, I saw an article talking about kind of traditional Japanese medicine, and specifically Miro disease. So Miro disease is, again, like a disease that is sort of specifically understood in certain parts of Japan and Pacific Islands. And it's basically a combination of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, and like a Parkinson's dementia sort of it's basically a combination of Parkinson's dementia and ALS, and they group them together and they call it Miro disease. And it's thought that, according to this article by Spencer et al. From 2021, actually, that one of the reasons that this may have come about, this disease, is the use of cicad seed. So in traditional Japanese medicine, in the places where this disease is prevalent or understood, the people use the cicad seed as a way of treating certain diseases. So in particular, hemorrhoids, I think, is the main one. But the cicad seed also has neurotoxic chemicals in it that they think may contribute to this ALS, Parkinson's kind of thing going on. But another element of it as well, which is quite interesting, is that in sort of traditional like Chinese culture, it's believed that obviously filial piety, so loyalty to your family and deference to your parents and things like that, is very, very important. And there's a book that kind of sets out, it's from the 1600s, which I guess is not technically, I don't think that's medieval, I'm not a historian, but that says that those who do not kind of respect their parents and their elders will in later life lose the ability to use their legs properly, which is thought to maybe be a reference to Parkinson's or to ALS. So I think this one paper, which the paper itself is quite small and specific, it covers like quite a lot of ground in terms of, firstly, like in these parts of Japan and the Pacific Islands, ALS and Parkinson's are grouped together. So whereas in the West, we would think Parkinson's is one thing, dementia is another thing, and ALS is something else. There they group them all together. So it raises interesting questions about the boundaries of a disease, like what is a disease and what are just symptoms. And that seems to vary by culture, and I'm sure it also varies by time as well. And then the other thing is how in the past people have understood disease to kind of function. So whereas in the, like, nowadays we know that something like syphilis is a sexually transmitted disease. In the past, they may have thought that it was punishment for immorality. So it's interesting, like, how those things have also developed over time. So I don't think the article is as important as what we might raise coming from it. And we can also think about the regional variation of disease as well. The fact that Muir disease is quite a specific Pacific Island disease that may not be seen in other parts, again, because of this whole cichlid seed thing. So lots of stuff, I think, for us to talk about.
So this disease is caused by this seed?
I think it's still speculative, because it's thought that it might be caused by this seed that is used fairly widely in Kampo medicine. But, it could, you know, like Parkinson's, especially in an aging population, and there are certain, especially in like Japan and that kind of part of the world, there are certain gene mutations within the population that are thought to contribute to longer lifespan and things like that. So I guess it's possible that things like Parkinson's and dementia could just come about naturally. But I don't know that much about ALS, but because that's the one where people are really concerned about, like, American football players and stuff, resulting from kind of minor repetitive brain damage. Like, that's a scare if you have been concussed like 5 times that you might develop ALS. So I don't know. I guess it could be the seed, but I guess there are other factors that could also be at play.
Because if they're saying that the seed, I'm just trying to get my head around this. So the seed may or may not cause this disease, which actually is a combination of 3 different diseases, which from our understanding are 3 different things.
Yeah.
They merge them together under one sort of umbrella. And that's because but they use the seed in medicine. What do they use? And the seed is used to treat hemorrhoids.
Yeah.
But it also causes neurological problems.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because, like, I wonder if they've isolated, have they isolated, like, the different parts of this seed and, like, the different, like, chemicals that...
Well...
Because, like, one could cause... But I suppose, like, in plants and plant medicine, I guess the good thing about it is that all their different, like, components all sort of mesh and work together in a synergistic way anyway. So if you separated them, it would probably have zero effect.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean... I'm not quite sure what, they don't mention exactly what compound within the seed is responsible for what's going on.
Yeah.
I think there are cases of similar things happening with a lot of stuff. I think it's one, like, kind of a misconception sometimes that people think that just because something is natural means that it's going to be good for you. Like, we all kind of automatically hear, like, natural medicine, and we think, oh, that's better than having some I don't know, some codeine or something like that. At the end of the day, like, codeine is synthesized from plants. Like,
yeah.
Like, codeine comes from a natural source. It's just a purer form of the compound that we're after. And similarly, like, just because something comes from nature doesn't mean it's not going to be dangerous and not going to be detrimental. So, yeah, I guess that's just, like, something to think about. And especially in the context of medieval medicine, where so many of these remedies were thought of as natural, like herbal remedies, the compounds that they're relying on a lot of the time are still the same compounds that we may use today. We've just learned to refine them much better.
I think yes, that is definitely true. And you do have like codeine, yeah, let's take that as an example. And we were lucky enough to be able to isolate something that did have an effect and then purify it and make it sort of standardized. But I think some of these remedies, if you do the tests on them, I've definitely seen that they just don't work and they just don't have any effect. And it's only when they're all working together in that compound, in those exact concentrations, that they do work, which I think is really cool. I think that's a really cool thing about natural medicine. But yeah, I do agree. I think it's interesting that we often think natural stuff is always good for you. And then we're looking at, say, this example here of this seed that's, okay, it's good for hemorrhoids, but actually it's detrimental to your brain health. We think. We're not sure. But yeah, I think it's quite cool.
It was interesting to note that they classed these conditions as neuro disease at that time. But even like now, we still have a syndrome, don't we? So we have a dementia syndrome, we have neurodegenerative conditions. They're still under the same umbrella. So it's interesting to note that, like, you can see where the connections were made, and we still would, to an extent, classify them as neuro disease. Like, it's not, they're not wildly different conditions. It's just a comment. It's not a question. It's more of a comment on the discussion. I don't know if you guys agree or.
So it's like the borders, like what Sam was saying before about like the borders of disease becoming blurred, like what you class as one, what you class as the other. And yeah, it's kind of like a syndrome. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's, I'm sure a lot of it is about just, like, because there is a lot of debate and the boundaries of disease, like what is defined by as a disease and not, is constantly shifting. I mean, like, a recent example is obviously COVID, where we've seen, like, over from the beginning of the pandemic to now, how the kind of, what are symptoms, what are not symptoms, things like hyposmia, which we didn't necessarily know was a symptom initially, that then ended up being a symptom, develop, like, throughout certain, like, neurological symptoms, potentially. Are they symptoms? Are they not of COVID? Still very much out for debate. So, you know, this is something that we see, like, unfold before us. But where we draw the boundaries of disease, I guess it's kind of a way of compartmentalizing certain disorders that we're trying to fix. And so if, I think it kind of ties into what Ellie was saying, that if you rely on herbal, if you rely on kind of natural medicine, where you have, you know, a specific leaf that you use that has lots of different compounds and lots of different but useful quantities, if that leaf will cure a particular disease or a particular set of symptoms, you're going to probably define disease by that set of symptoms that you can cure with that leaf. Whereas nowadays in you know, Western medicine, we can prescribe 5 different pills that work in combination with each other, but they're all kind of going after different symptoms, if you get what I mean. Mm-hmm. So I guess part of it is just, how do we conceptualize disease from a healthcare point of view that allows us to treat that disease in a way that we can kind of handle? And that's going to be different depending on what resources you have in a healthcare system.
But disease and treatment, so there are a couple of things that he mentioned. So I was just like, you're not, the thing is, nowadays, I think, generally, we don't cure condition, we treat the symptoms. But I don't know if we don't fully always cure a certain disease, a certain condition. So I think there's a difference between, I don't know how they would have, I don't know what I'm saying, Ellie, you go.
I was going to say that I think it's, when we talk about diagnosing a disease, like diagnosing COVID, you've got a COVID infection. Yes, it's a collection of symptoms and that leads you. But for us, we diagnose it by identifying a set lesion or a set virus or a, like, by culturing that and finding that pathogen. Whereas in medieval times, they wouldn't have been able to do that. So all they have to go off is this set of symptoms. So I guess it's kind of because we're able to find, oh, this specific bacteria or virus is what's causing your symptoms or this lesion or this mass, then we're able to sort of tailor the treatments better, aren't we? We're able to be like, well, this does this and this does this to it and this does this, so have these three pills. Whereas at the time they're like, oh, you've got a bit of a cold, have some lemon and ginger, and they don't know exactly what's wrong with it because they don't have, yeah, wouldn't have had the technology that we do now. So I suppose you just sort of go off, yeah, folklore and what seems to work. A bit like, exactly, a bit like how we do now with symptomatic treatment, like Natasha was saying, like, you don't necessarily always have to find the, we definitely do it in veterinary medicine, like the root of the disease the whole time. If you give it this medicine and it's working and it feels better, great.
But yeah. I think that's, oops, sorry, I think that's like, I think that's based very much on, you know, we can rely on these technologies and these resources to be able to test these specific things. Like, we can find out exactly what microorganism or virus or pathological part, like cellular pathway, is going wrong that's causing this particular disease. But obviously in, and it's not even in medieval times, it's just in kind of less developed parts of the world or where they use kind of traditional medicine as opposed to Western medicine, they don't have access to these things. So the way that they're going to define disease will probably rely more on the way that they can, the only way they can see that disease is how they're treating it or the kind of manifest symptoms that you can see. But I think it goes the other way too, because often, and I've heard, like, you know, clinicians talk about this before, that we can become very focused on the names of diseases in the West, that, you know, we think like, oh, well, you know, this can't be this other disease because it's not specifically isolated to this place. But an example, again, another medieval example of the bubonic plague. I mean, the bubonic plague is caused by bacterium Yersinia pestis, which comes from fleas that bite the rats. And, you know, we know that story. But depending on where Y. pestis finds itself in your body, it can lead to very, very different outcomes. So bubonic plague, which is obviously the one with the skin lesions and things like that, ends up being fatal about 50% of the time. Versus if you end up with septicemic plague, so it finds its way into your bloodstream, you're finished. It's 100% of people who get septicemic plague die. So in that situation, we have the same microorganism. So we would define it as the same disease, and yet there are radically different outcomes. So I think there's a lot of, like, looking, you know, not necessarily towards traditional medicine as kind of being like, this is what we're aspiring to, but rather kind of trying to take a step back and being like, sometimes you don't want to be too analytical about it, too, I'll say detail oriented, you know what I mean? Like, too focused on what the organism is doing and trying to take a step back and being like, well, actually, what does this mean for the patient? And there's like a balance between the two, I feel.
No, I agree, because I think in clinical practice, often you may not actually end up with a absolute diagnosis. I feel like number one priority is making the patient feel comfortable, right? They come in through the door, they're displaying a display of symptoms, things like pain, temperature, you know, whatever, coryzal symptoms, so on and so forth. Your first thing is obviously you want to try and find out what's causing this. Is it sepsis? Is it an infection? What is it? But that's not the first thing you do. The first thing is like, okay, this person's in pain. Let me prescribe them some analgesia. Let me make them comfortable. That's your first port of call. And at the same time, you're trying to figure out what's happening. So it's really, really important, I think, to recognize, which I think comes from, I suppose, how they used to treat people in medieval, because to them, it was an unwell patient. It was very hard for them to find out what caused it. They were like, I want to make this patient feel, not patient, person, feel better. You know? Yeah.
It's probably all witchcraft.
All witchcraft.
my paper is quite different. I guess it's kind of similar, going off a little bit of these sort of remedies. But my paper came from the Journal of Ethnobiology and Ethnomedicine, which is obviously the relationship between people and whatever we're talking about. So my paper is talking about the relationship between people and freshwater fish in Europe. And yeah, I know, I told you it was a bit rogue. And how the medieval fisheries sort of have like their cultural significance, basically, in a range of things, one of them being medicine in medieval times. This paper is quite a broad one because it does really go through the history of fishing. So I read and learned a lot about how people have fished and how it has changed. And I'm not a very, I don't fish, I've never fished, so it was quite interesting. Do you fish, Sam?
Yeah.
Nice, you're gonna know everything then. So how do you pronounce this word? Ethnotrichology?
Ethnotrichology.
That one.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, that's, I don't think most fishermen would know that word, but it's just my Greek knowledge that I like.
Oh, okay, there we go. Well, anyway, it's on that, a freshwater fish in Europe and how traditional fisheries and how they're vanishing sort of has an impact, etc. But obviously for this, the purpose of this discussion, it's mainly focusing on medieval stuff. So I found it interesting to find out how people used to fish in medieval times as well, because they used to like hit fish with like bludgeons to sort of stun them, or even use poison. And then a lot later, sort of the 1800s, people were using dynamite, which I know that's not medieval, but I thought those are all very interesting ways of fishing. And they dug up this boat from 1628 that, again, I'm not sure if that's medieval period or maybe a bit later, but they sort of managed to still isolate these bones and find out exactly what fish people were eating, and if you ate bigger fish then you were richer, and if you ate poorer smaller fish then you were poorer. Yes, I learned a lot, but I'm just getting to the medicine-y bit, like the nitty-gritty. So medical uses of fish in medieval times. The main fish that they used to use was called the tench fish. I say that, the tench fish, which was known as the doctor fish. And they used to use the really thick mucus that covered its body to like rub on wounds and things, because that was supposed to sort of heal wounds. And what they used to do is they used to put them in smaller ponds with other fish as a sort of doctor for the other fish, to stop the other fish getting ill. Because they used to watch them, they'd watch the tench fish rubbing against the other fish and thought, oh, they must be sort of healing each other. But obviously, I'm not sure whether that's just a behavioural thing, or maybe it is self-medication that opens up a whole other can of worms of animals self-medicating and things. But I thought that was quite interesting how they used to pop them in the smaller ponds as a sort of medicinal thing. And then they also used to use the fish bones in the skull for medical preparations. And they used to use in Spain the blood, bile, fat, and the fish meat to treat alcoholism and obesity in Spain, in medieval Spain. So I thought that was really interesting. That was my article. It's a bit rogue, I know.
I perked up a little bit when you said that, because in my like search I did find an article, and in part because so when you talked about like figuring out what fish people ate, I remember in my undergrad one of like my additional modules that I took, and actually originally what I wanted to study was archaeology and biological anthropology, and so I have like a I don't want to say secret passion because that sounds weird, but I have like an interest, shall we say, in human diet, in human evolutionary diet, and it's really interesting how you can look at, so normally they're looking at I think it's 14 or 13 carbon and nitrogen isotopes in the bones, and you can kind of figure out like whether human populations survived off land, meat, or fish as their primary source of protein. Very, very interesting. But I was gonna make the point as well that I think the reliance on fish in medieval times is really interesting, because in a paper that I looked at, they talk about climate change is obviously something that is really big for us now, that there's a lot of attention on. But I think a lot of the time people don't realize that climate change was actually very significant in the medieval era as well. They went through a period of warmth followed by a period like called the Little Ice Age, because like the kind of air temperature dropped by about 2 degrees in Europe. And it kind of led to a shift in subsistence strategies. Like people moved towards the water to kind of find food. So especially in Spain, they have lots of evidence that people increasingly relied on fish to eat as opposed to crops, because crops just weren't growing as well. But then you've got to think about, well, what are the and I guess it kind of gets to what Ellie was talking about like fish farming and things like that. But also, what about the disease impacts of that? Like, what about, for example, parasite transmission and things? Like, if we're subsisting more off other animals as opposed to plants, what does that mean for diseases and especially kind of parasites and stuff that kick up within the population? Like, climate change can have those impacts on our diet, which then lead to differences in disease as well. So I just thought that was like an interesting
point. Yeah, that's really cool. I wonder if they've done any, well, they must have done studies on that, must have they, like looked at whether the incidence of disease, mind you, I suppose that's quite broad, isn't it? I was going to say the incidence of disease increased with like the temperature or whatever. Because yeah, it just would increase, wouldn't it? If you have, if you're eating more meat in medieval times and you're not storing it properly, or you're keeping it in warm, like it, you will get parasites. Like, especially because they're not going to be routinely worming their cows.
They might not even know about it. Yeah. Although one thing I found as well, I looked at way too many papers, but is the helminth. So helminth prevalence in medieval Europe was very, very high. And again, it's probably because, like you said, like they weren't worming their, I mean, helminth infection in the West nowadays is almost non-existent, very, very low. Whereas in the developing world, it's very common, helminth infection. I don't know if you guys know this about it, but like helminths, so that there's supposedly an so there is some advantage to helminth infection. I don't know if you've heard about this, that helminths, so things like, like Ascularis, like nematodes and stuff like that. I think it's called Ascularis, isn't it? Like a very common one. They have an immunosuppressive effect. So while helminth infection is obviously not great for your digestive system and stuff, there is a much lower prevalence of autoimmune disease in the developing world compared to the developed world. And they think that part of that is down to the hygiene hypothesis, that we just don't expose ourselves to as much stuff in the West because we're hyper clean on everything. But another one is, I think that supposedly it might be that helminths help suppress your immune system so that it doesn't become overactive and you don't end up feeling like things like asthma, things like psoriasis and stuff like that. It may be why it's less common. So, you know, maybe that also had an impact on medieval Europe as well. But I think it also highlights how we think of like medieval health stuff as being medieval, but actually for a lot of like the problems that plagued medieval Europe, we can just look to the developing world nowadays and it's exactly the same, like exactly the same problems that were plagued in Europe 500 years ago. I mean, the bubonic plague still exists in Madagascar, so you know, we don't necessarily have to look back, we just have to look elsewhere in the world and we can see these things happening.
Do they know if well, they probably do. I was going to say the helminth and autoimmune disease and immunosuppression. Is that a specific thing to helminths, or is it just because you've got a high parasite burden and you've got systemic disease, you're going to be immunosuppressed?
No, I think it is a specific parasite thing, because the parasite doesn't want your immune system to react. I mean, one of the, kind of like we were talking about with Professor Gupta, one of our previous episodes, that, you know, like as a virus, I guess, like you don't want the humans to realize that you're there, because then the humans are going to try to get rid of you. But even on like a micro level, you don't want the body to realize you're there either, because then you're going to elicit the body's immune response and then you're done for, basically. So it's the same with, I think parasites can have slightly more complex ways of evading the body's immune system. I mean, the best example is malaria, which goes between a haploid and diploid, state, which allows it to sort of remove any kind of like genetic tags that may allow your body to go after it, which is why malaria is so difficult to you know develop vaccines for and stuff like that. But yeah, like I think it's meant to be part of the nematodes trying to, or the helminths, sorry, trying to dodge the immune system and dodge the immune response. But that can have benefits as well. Obviously, it also is like very, very bad for your health. So I'm not saying go and eat some infected meat. but like, yeah, like there are kind of implications on that. And then we can kind of also think about how that might have affected, you know, medieval Europe as well, or other medieval parts of the world.
One thing you mentioned, that they used fish skins, isn't it, for like wound healing and wound kind of closure and stuff.
Yeah.
Have you heard, I don't know if I'm making this up, but I think there are like fish skin grafts that are used, or they're trialing that at the moment.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And I was like, I wonder if there's some connection between that era and what we're using now, because I don't know exactly like how it works or like why it's known to be beneficial, but I think it's more for like there's something to close it, you are stopping infection from entering the wound. And I think there's something about the fact that omega 3 fatty acids can have like a bacterial barrier, or like it can help with pain or something along those lines. I have very, very little knowledge on that, but that's something I briefly read about. But it's very interesting that they did that and they thought to do that in the medieval period.
Yeah, that like how did they I suppose it's like anything, isn't it? How do you figure out in the first place? Like, I don't think they would have been going around putting fish skins on stuff just
for the sake of it.
Like just to see if it worked.
A nice little fish odour, like fish perfume.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe they did.
You never know though. Back then, I guess research ethics weren't a thing, were they? So you can just go and do whatever you want. Is you'll get like bringing images now, like Jason Momoa as Aquaman, like with the scaly skin. You know? You have like a big skin, you can be like a mermaid. You have like a full fish skin graft.
I wonder if that's where like mermaids came from. Not obviously mermaids came from. No, it probably wouldn't have been.
Have you ever heard of like the? Have you heard of Barnum Circus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the very messed up things that he would do to, you know, like he had like things of like I found like a real life mermaid, and he basically just like got a monkey and got a large fish and just cut each of them in half and then sewed the fish part to the monkey, and then obviously he kept it as like, obviously it's not alive, but just like floating in a little formaldehyde jar, and just be like, I found a real life mermaid. So
maybe, you know, yeah, right. Like,
I don't think that's where it came from. It's interesting. I guess that kind of does play into what we're talking about. Like, you know, these where do these myths come from about these animals? I guess it's the same place where some of the things about, like, yeah, like, you know, if you're not loyal to your family and your parents, then you're going to end up with Parkinson's. Like, if you don't understand where these diseases come from, what the pathology of them is, then it's very easy to kind of buy into anything. Again, like, I don't want to keep going about COVID, but yeah, there's a lot of, like, conspiracy theories and things like that with COVID now, and you think to yourself like, well, how can people have such crazy ideas about, you know, like how can Parkinson's be related to how nice you are to your parents? But actually people believe some crazy things when it comes to COVID as well, when we don't have really all of the evidence and all of the information yet. So it makes you realize like how these things can take off. I think another thing that, like, maybe we should talk about, like, briefly, again, like we talked about in one of our previous episodes, is, like, the idea of, like, different, like, regional diseases, how, like, in medieval times, in some of, like, the reading that I did, one of the big things that kind of led to death was travel, and in particular, people catching diseases. Because, you know, in medieval communities, people generally would live within like the same 20-mile radius, and they would never leave for generations of their family. So you can imagine, like, in isolated communities could get quite specific diseases that applied to them that didn't really apply to outsiders, and somebody else coming in hasn't developed that immunity. So nowadays, in like a much more global world, we get all of our shots, and there's a lot more mixing of disease and immunity and stuff like that. But I guess that's like quite significant as well, especially when we think of you know, nowadays in the way that like COVID, like all the different strains of COVID that are developing on these small scales and then get out, like, yeah, like in medieval times, that you would have just had like your isolated little strain, your little community. It may never have got out because nobody would have ever left except for the occasional trader or maybe a soldier going off to another country to fight or something like that.
So they're more like outbreaks, less pandemics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you just have like a little outbreak in your... But I guess like we still see like similar things. Like at university, if you have like an outbreak of...
That's true.
I don't know, like a vomiting bug or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a similar thing.
Freshest flu.
Yeah, freshest flu. That's like a prime example, isn't it? Everyone gets freshest flu.
I wonder if there's any research on freshest flu specifically.
I'm sure there is.
That doesn't sound like something I want to read.
Well, because I thought... Because it's like... Actually, no, because you get freshers flu before the end of term. But actually, no, because you know how, like, sometimes when you get freshers flu and you go home and then you bring it back home and then everybody at home gets sick as well? And it's kind of like, I don't know, I feel like it's, like, a really interesting, like, micro-environment to study the transmission of disease, like, on, like, a, like think about, like, between countries and stuff like that. Mm. I wonder if anybody's thought of doing that before. Probably not.
Well, also,
like, new research idea, Sam.
Yeah, I know.
When you're publishing the study.
Yeah.
Write a little paper. I was going to say really quickly before we finish, like, I think the way of us tackling diseases, even on like these small little scales, like freshest flu, has definitely changed. I remember doing a practical a couple of years ago before COVID, and everyone's suggestion for, oh, there's been an outbreak of this bug. What do you do? And everyone's response was just so different from the response that it was this year, which would be isolate, like track and trace, like lock the child in a room and don't let them see anyone. And like no one would have even thought of saying that like 2 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Like the impact that this pandemic has on the way we view this general disease.
No, even like things like, so going into work slightly sick, like having a little like flu-like symptoms, people would not go. Like, I think before you kind of push the boundaries and depends like how sick you are and if it's actually affecting your functionality. Whereas you have any flu-like symptoms, like a runny nose, a little bit of a cough, you're not going to work.
You're not going out and you're not going outside.
Exactly.
It's almost kind of medieval, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I know. Because if you think about what, like during the bubonic plague and stuff like that, that's what, you know, people had to isolate. They had to stay away from people, and it is similar to what we were saying in the last episode as well about how kind of people nowadays, I think especially because of COVID, people are terrified of just getting sick at all, when actually getting sick is that's how you fight disease. Like, you don't fight disease by not getting sick, you fight disease by getting sick and beating it. So obviously, like, not saying go outside and lick every lamppost that you see you get COVID, but like it is, I do think it's very interesting how like our attitude to disease has changed just in the past year, really. But yeah, interesting food for thought.
Yeah, I feel like we've had quite a good discussion on quite a range of topics in this episode. It's been quite good. Enjoyed it. If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media. We've been Ellie, Sam and Natasha, bringing you another episode of the Inspired Podcast. Please like or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter at inspiredjournalpodcast and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify or any other podcasting platform. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue to bring you the content that you love. The Inspired Podcast is brought to you by the Inspire Student Journal. You can visit our journal website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk to find out more. See you next time.
We're students and we're all still learning, so we appreciate any comments, feedback or error corrections in relation to the topics discussed. All research presented is correct at the time of recording. Any medical information provided does not constitute official medical advice. Consult your own physician for any medical issues that you may be experiencing. Views expressed in the Inspire Journal podcast are of the hosts and guests, do not represent the views of the Inspire Student Journal or any institutions we are attached to.